Local news, culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Well, coming up, we've got something very special. This is the debut of Health on the Margins, Radio Catskill's brand new podcast focusing on rural health issues, produced by Kimberly Izar. Kimberly will be joining me in the studio in just one moment. But first up, to get us started, we do have news out of Utica, New York, where yesterday was the start of the high-profile trial of three corrections officers charged with murder for the beating death of prisoner Robert Brooks. Special Prosecutor William Fitzpatrick told jurors that a group of guards at the Marcy Correctional Facility kicked and punched Brooks until he was unconscious. Fitzpatrick said in his opening statement that jurors would watch footage of the beating captured on body-worn cameras.
They no longer were corrections officers. They were a gang. They took turns, collectively and individually, of punching him, kneeing him, pepper spraying him.
Brooks was pronounced dead at a nearby hospital. Lawyers for the three defendants say their actions didn't cause Brooks' death. Six other corrections officers have pleaded guilty to manslaughter and other charges in connection with Brooks' death. And thank you to the New York Public News Network for that report. Now I want to welcome on air my colleague here at Radio Catskill. It's Kimberly Izar. We are talking about the start of the brand new podcast, Health on the Margins. Kimberly, you've been working on this for a while. I'm excited to talk to you about it. Welcome to the local edition.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Jason.
This is going to be like a limited series podcast, but this is basically a chance for you to do a real deep dive on the many issues affecting healthcare in our area.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the idea of this podcast actually started in a really organic way. I started attending the county legislative meetings, and I realized very early on that people were very fired up when they talked about healthcare. A lot of times people have to travel really long distances to access healthcare, and then when they actually get there, it's not the healthcare that they need, or when they access healthcare within the county, they find it inadequate. And so the idea for this podcast really started with asking this question: what ideas do community members who actually live in rural communities actually have when it comes to healthcare?
Wow. So you're talking to people that are impacted by the care that's available, as well as those who provide the care?
Exactly. And this is what we'll hear in this first episode, which talks about the state of the opioid crisis. We hear directly from a mother who has been directly affected by the opioid crisis. Her son, Jonathan, died in 2024, as well as talking to a Sullivan County commissioner who oversees healthcare and human services at the county level. But then other episodes that, you know, we'll hear later in the next few months. Also, we talk to people who administer the opioid settlement funds that we've been seeing a lot about, as well as seniors. We have a lot of senior care centers up here in the region, and there have been conflicting views as to whether or not it actually provides the care that seniors need.
The podcast debuts today, and the new episodes will come down the first Wednesday of the month. Folks can listen online at wjffradio.org. It's wjffradio.org. We'll get to hear this first episode tonight.
Exactly. And I want to encourage people, you know, I said in the beginning that this podcast really started in an organic way. If people have ideas or feedback as we put this podcast together, don't be afraid to let us know. You can leave a comment wherever you get your podcast. You can also send us an email at feedback@wjffradio.org. Don't be afraid to reach out.
All right. Well, Kimberly, thank you so much for doing this work. I look forward to listening to this episode with the listener. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks, Jason.
All right. Well, let's get right into it.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar. A note for our listeners, this episode discusses substance use and addiction and may be difficult to listen to. At an evening vigil in late August, hundreds gather on the lawn outside the Monticello Courthouse. They're holding candles and photos of loved ones who have died. On the steps of the courthouse is Dorothy Sanchez. She's wearing a black t-shirt, with a photo of a young man who's smiling.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Dorothy Sanchez, and I'm here today as a mother who lost her youngest son, Jonathan Sanchez, to addiction.
The photo on Sanchez's shirt is of her son. She's speaking at an Overdose Awareness Day vigil in August. It's a day to celebrate those on the path to recovery, but also to remember those who have died from an overdose. Children, spouses, friends, neighbors, and daughters and sons.
He's known in the streets as Wavy. Jonathan was my baby boy. He was my biggest supporter. He was a great friend, and everyone who met him loved him.
There's another photo to the left of Sanchez. It shows two hands intertwined.
I brought this photo here. It's a haunting moment, frozen in time for me. That's my husband, holding Jonathan's hand after we had to identify his body. I will never forget the cold of that moment, not just the temperature of his skin, but the cold reality of it all. We stood over our son, and we looked at each other and didn't know what to do or say.
We'll hear more from Sanchez in just a few. In New York, an estimated 4,500 New Yorkers died from an overdose in 2024, according to the CDC. That's a sharp decline from what the state has reported in previous years. Many see this as progress, but for many of the families who have already lost loved ones, the fight against opioids can already feel over. From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Health on the Margins, a series that looks at the Catskills and eastern Pennsylvania's fragile healthcare deserts. Over the past few decades, the number of health providers has declined. Community hospitals have closed, and access to what is available is getting further and further from home. Health on the Margins digs into how we got here and where our rural region may head next. I'm Kimberly Izar. So we decided to do a special series focused on healthcare because we've heard for years from our listening area that healthcare is something that really matters to you, and largely because there aren't many healthcare options in rural areas. Rural residents often face limited access to healthcare specialists, more geographic isolation, and are less likely to have comprehensive health insurance coverage. We felt it was appropriate to start the series with an issue that has haunted rural communities for decades, and that's the opioid epidemic. Opioid-related overdose deaths jumped more than 400% among New York State residents from 2010 to 2022, according to State Health Department data. But for Sullivan County, this is an epidemic that has plagued the county for decades. Sullivan County has notoriously ranked at the top of a list for years that they don't want to be first on.
Sullivan County faces a harsh reality, the highest per capita overdose rate in the whole state. It's not the highest in number because it's not that big a county, but per capita it is, and that's a very, very important and worrisome statistic that we have to do something about.
That's New York Senator Chuck Schumer back in 2023 at a press conference when Sullivan County was formally designated a high-intensity drug traffic area by the federal government. Today, we hear from the families and public health providers on the front lines of the opioid crisis, many still grieving. As New York enters a new phase in the opioid crisis, what will it take to move people from simply surviving an overdose to living a dignified life? Dorothy Sanchez is one mom trying to figure out a life forward after her son Jonathan died from an overdose.
He was my baby. He is the only child I had with my husband. And he was charismatic, compassionate, congenial, loving, supportive, and he had a special capacity to connect with people, like all kinds of people.
Jonathan was 33 years old when he died from an overdose in September of 2024. He was pronounced dead at the Garnet Health Catskills campus in Harris, New York.
The last time I saw Jonathan alive, I was in front of my church. He was walking through, he had a knapsack. And he was talking to my mom and my daughter. I was still upset with him. I was talking to some other people, and somebody came out of my church, and she said, "Isn't that your son?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Go to him." And inside of my mind, I was just thinking, she doesn't know. She can't even imagine what it is to be in this situation and how hurt I am. You know, my mind was going like that. But eventually I walked over to him and he put out his arms to hug me. And I didn't hug him back. And I remember the last thing I said. I said, "Really, Jonathan? After everything you told me, I guess the next thing I'll hear is either you're in jail or you overdosed." That's the last words I said to my son.
I first met Sanchez at a public meeting in Hurleyville for Sullivan County's Substance Use Task Force. When she and I set up time to chat, she gave me the book she wrote called Jonathan's Legacy. It's her personal memoir to remember Jonathan. Sanchez told me that Jonathan overdosed weekly in the final 2 months leading up to his death. She said she's still trying to make sense of the devastation and grief that followed.
How do you behave? Like, what do you, when you see your child just not alive anymore? There's no more words. There's no more anger. There's no more pettiness. There's no more who's right. It's just over.
Was there a turning point into which some of the substance use issues really started coming to light for him?
Yeah. So the exercise, what I did with my grief as I wrote this book, so I had a lot of time to really think about it.
Yeah.
And I did see some shifts.
In his early 20s, Jonathan headed to Nyack College in Rockland County for school. He met someone and they eventually got married.
But it wound up being a problem. She wound up, I know in that time he started experimenting with drugs.
Jonathan and his former wife eventually separated. And after that, Sanchez said he fell deeper and deeper into drugs. He was admitted many times at the Garnet Health Campus in Harris over the years, as well as several county jails, including Ulster County Jail, Orange County Jail, and as far as Lakeview Shock Incarceration Center in Brocktown, New York. That's about 5 hours from Sullivan County. Jonathan needed help, but there were few to no long-term inpatient treatment programs in Sullivan County. Sanchez would beg the hospital to keep him for longer, but New York State's mental hygiene law limited how long he could stay. He was often released the same day he was admitted, often just hours after an overdose.
The hospital would just release him because, right? That's, the system doesn't allow for anything to happen except for try to stop them from dying. Then put them back out. Try to stop them from dying and put them back out. And I couldn't do anything.
Here is the beginning of a voicemail Jonathan left Sanchez while he was in the hospital.
"Mom, can you please call me back when you get this? Please. Can you call me back? I really need to be involved. I'm in the hospital and I need your help. Please. I love you."
So how did we get here? To help me understand how the county ranked the highest opioid overdose rate per capita for years, I spoke to John Little. He's the Health and Human Services Commissioner for Sullivan County, and he says the story actually begins nearly a century ago.
How did we get here, I think, is, you know, a combination of anybody that follows this issue, it wouldn't really be a mystery. I think... the economy and the Catskills really took a beating as the hotels wound down in the 80s and then, you know, a little bit more into the 90s. So there's automatically an opportunity for drug use to take root in a community like that, where there was a functioning industry, and perhaps even more so because it was a tourist industry, that, you know, the folks that were left behind by the hotels weren't left with a lot.
The hotels Little is referring to is when the Catskills still had a thriving region known as the Borscht Belt, From the 1920s through the 1960s, Jewish Americans opened up as many as 500 hotels in the Catskills after many existing establishments excluded vacationing Jews. But things changed over time as the rest of the world opened up. According to the Borschtfeld Historical Marker Project, new affordable airfares to Europe stole crowds of tourists, and the draw of the Catskills declined. Most of the resorts soon closed, and many local businesses filed for bankruptcy.
So the conditions were ripe. And then I think Sullivan County got the double whammy because all of this happened when Purdue Pharma and, you know, the opioid manufacturers realized that they could make a ton of profit on numbing the pain.
Right.
And so when you put those things together, it creates a scenario where really Sullivan County was doomed, not for its own fault, but just because it was a victim of circumstances.
In 2010, opioid prescribing peaked. This was just around the time when local hospital systems were also struggling and beginning to consolidate. The River Reporter detailed how in the early 2000s, the county's community general hospital went through multiple rounds of layoffs. The trend of shrinking healthcare providers continued. In the past 2 years alone, Sullivan County's primary healthcare system, Garnet Health, has laid off more than 60 employees to manage ongoing financial constraints and scaled back several services. How does the region's broader healthcare challenges affect the county's ability to address the opioid overdose epidemic?
Yeah, that's a great question that we're really wrestling with right now. So I guess a couple of things to start on that piece of the conversation is that there was a lot of news when Catholic Charities closed shop as a provider in the community. And we noticed in the drug task force that there were a lot of concerns in the community, like, oh my God, where do we go now? But it's important for folks to know that, you know, the county has a dual diagnosis mental health and substance use clinic. Where we're lacking is an inpatient facility. And fortunately, that's where the partnership between Lexington and Garnet Health has come together with support from New York State OASAS to fund an inpatient treatment facility inside of the Garnet Health Harris campus.
2 years ago, a shift happened. Sullivan County moved from being the highest overdose rate per capita to third. Little says they did this through a number of ways. More Narcan distribution, working with police on alternative incarceration programs, and more. But even with all these support systems in place, Dorothy Sanchez says it wasn't enough to save her son. In his final year, her son Jonathan was beginning to look less and less like himself. He'd call her if he needed something to eat. They'd usually send Uber or other takeout because it became too difficult to deal with in person.
And I know a lot of families are struggling with it. That's why I wrote the book, because we don't know what to do.
Life-saving efforts like Narcan, she says, helped save Jonathan and other lives many, many times. But she says the county needs to focus on a new question. What about building a life after Narcan?
It's always about management and their addiction, survival management, maintain them in their dependency. And for some reason, rescue, freedom, and hope are never discussed anymore. It's not even on the table.
Little says that he agrees with this criticism.
Healthcare is so much of a business in this country that providers have a financial interest, even if, and I don't mean to criticize individual providers who are there for their patients, 100%, but the industry is set up to maintain and sustain itself.
Coming up,
New York is seeing a historic decrease in reported overdose deaths.
But with threats of looming cuts at the federal level, those who lead local drug recovery and treatment services are increasingly concerned.
Sullivan County is in a new phase of its fight against opioids. But what does a path forward look like in the wake of federal cuts? We hear more from Sanchez and Little about their ideas on how to end the epidemic. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill, Listen local.
Ask. I think that DHS would say, look, these immigration agents are doing their job. And from the perspective of a lot of people in Chicago, especially people who are Latino and feel unfairly attacked, they would say, look, this is a rogue police force.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
This is a local edition. I'm Jason Dole, and you're here with me for a very special episode of the Local Edition because we've got the debut of Health on the Margins, Radio Catskill's brand new podcast. It's produced by Kimberly Izar. Let's go back to Kimberly now.
We're back with Health on the Margins and Kimberly Izar. If you're just joining us, we've been chatting with Sullivan County Commissioner John Little. He's talking about the new chapter that rural communities are in their fight against substance use. Overdose deaths are down nationwide, but investment in treatment services may be on the chopping board.
New York is seeing a historic decrease in reported overdose deaths.
But with threats of looming cuts at the federal level, those who lead local drug recovery and treatment services are increasingly concerned.
That's a clip from NewsAid WROC in Rochester. Those threats is something Little is really concerned about. In July, the Trump administration delayed roughly $140 million in grants to fund fentanyl overdose efforts.
We're very concerned about the changes that have been made via the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, what that means for folks who are going through substance use disorder treatment, and the work requirements that come with the changes in Medicaid. Quite frankly, we're not optimistic right now. And the One Big Beautiful Bill Act has set things up so that folks are going to be cut off of Medicaid in the millions around the state. And that's a very scary proposition, especially for substance use disorder treatment, because Narcan, like I said, is preventing death, but it takes focused, dedicated treatment to really promote life. And you can't do that with an outpatient visit once or twice a week, at least at the outset. It takes some real focused and dedicated care. And so that creates a problem with where we're going with Medicaid.
Having that long-term dedicated care Little describes is something that Dorothy Sanchez said could have helped save her son Jonathan's life.
The number one issue that I saw was when he overdosed, not letting him back out in the street. Number one, everybody knows that that is a red flag that needs rescue. Now that person is in trouble. That person is a danger to himself now. His addiction is out of control and obviously can't make good decisions anymore. And we need to have a message, because I get everybody's concerned about words like mandate and, you know, people's rights and all this stuff. But we have to have some moral courage to say, we're not going to let people die. We see this, it's not working. We're not going to allow people to die here anymore.
Sanchez says it's not going to be just one solution that ends the epidemic, but many. She thinks a mandated order for treatment is one thing that could have helped. Several states have some form of mandated involuntary commitment for substance use, but it hasn't come without pushback. Sanchez is currently trying to collect signatures for county legislation to invest in long-term rehabilitation options after an overdose. She's calling it Jonathan's legacy.
Not prison, not jail, not hospitals, not psych wards, the addiction. See, getting high is a choice. Addiction is the trap. It's the suffocating factor. And we need to... When somebody's in a trap, they need help to get out of, and they're in traps.
The County Substance Use Task Force is looking at policy solutions like this, as well as alternatives to incarceration programs like Hope Not Handcuffs. Part of the solution, Little says, has to be building community.
A community that people want to be a part of, that is hostile to bad actors that want to bring poison into the community, but also supportive of those who have fallen victim to it. And if you can strike that balance, which is hard to do day by day, because there are folks in recovery that disappoint you when they stumble. And, you know, there are law enforcement responses that maybe could be heavy-handed, or not strong enough on the flip side. But suffice to say, there is a balance that needs to be struck in this whole fight of supporting folks in need and punishing those who look to do harm to us. And the better we strike that balance, the more likely we are to overcome it in the end.
Before we stop recording, Sanchez said she wanted to play me a voice message from her son, Jonathan, not to exploit her son's pain, but to honor his truth. She says it captures the struggle that thousands of families experience.
In this message, it captures a moment of clarity and sorrow, desperation, and I believe it speaks louder than any statistic ever could. I want you to hear that addiction is not just a behavior, it's a torment of the soul. My son did not want to die. He wanted help. And he tried again and again to break free, but the system gave him medication and short-term programs and even jail time, but not the kind of real long-term treatment that could have saved his life.
Hey, Mom. It's me. Jonathan, I love you. I'm sorry about everything. I really do wish I could be consistent about things in my life that matter. I'm really, you know, like, I don't know, this relapse has been this torture for me. Like, I've been torturing myself over and over. And I just don't know what to do. But I just want to let you know I love you.
There's too many parents that get these kind of calls and hear their children and don't know what to do. I think that this is not it's not a police problem. It's not a legal problem. It's not just a family problem. It's all of us together deciding that we're going to do everything we can to eliminate the problem. Not harm reduction, harm elimination, right? And to give them hope, give them support, hope, and a future. That's what we have to do.
Throughout our reporting for this series, we found a lot of reporting on the challenges facing rural America, but we didn't find many stories by people who have lived it and what ideas they have to address the gaps. Every episode, we'll talk to people on the front lines of building a more equitable and accessible healthcare system in the Catskills. We'll take a pulse on the region from different corners, from our senior care centers to declining women's healthcare services in the region. Healthcare can often feel big and complex, and it is. But there are solutions and perspectives that we think deserve a closer look. Next time, we follow the money on opioid settlement funds. That's next time on Health on the Margins. If you or someone you know needs help, you can find treatment and support at findtreatment.gov. You can also call the 988 Lifeline at 988 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if you need someone to talk to. Health on the Margins is hosted, reported, and produced by me, Kimberly Izar, with contributed reporting by Julia Kim and Patricio Raballo. Editorial support by Tim Bruno, Jason Dole, Ronald Kelson, and Patricio Raballo. The music in this episode is from Tata Music and Hits Lab from Pixabay.
And thank you so much to Kimberly Izar, Radio Catskill reporter, for producing that brand new podcast. You just heard the debut episode of Health on the Margins. New episodes debut every first Wednesday of the month for this limited run podcast series, diving deep into the rural healthcare issues affecting our listening area. Find it at wjffradio.org. Check out all the podcasts we have up at wjffradio.org or get it wherever you get your podcasts from. For now, that's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back here again with you tomorrow. Right now, we have more news on the way from the Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Conover Club Restaurant, located at the intersection of Roscoe, Livingston Manor, Jeffersonville, and Calicoon. Featuring seasonal menus crafted with locally sourced ingredients. Hours, reservations, and upcoming events at conoverclub.com. and from the Neversink General Store, featuring deli sandwiches, gourmet specials, and catering. TheNeversinkGeneralStore.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and